Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Jewish Studies, a podcast channel of New Books Network. I'm your host, Schneur Zalman Neufeld. In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, over 300 young Jewish women from Orthodox, mostly Hasidic, homes in Western Galicia, now Poland, fled their homes and sought refuge in a Krakow convent, where many converted to Catholicism. Relying on a wealth of archival documents, including court testimonies, letters, diaries, and press reports, Rachel Menken reconstructs the stories of three Jewish women runaways and reveals their struggles and innermost convictions. In The Rebellion of the Daughters, Jewish Women Runaways in Habsburg, Galicia, published by Princeton University Press in 2020, Menken brings to light a forgotten yet significant episode in Eastern European history. Rachel Menken is an associate professor of Jewish studies at the University of Maryland. Welcome, Rachel, to our program.
Thank you for having me on.
To get us started here, could you tell us a little bit about your background and what led you to this project?
Okay, so I'm a historian of Galician Jewry. I'm mostly interested in social and political history. Galicia being the southeastern part of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, which was annexed to the Habsburg Empire in 1772, which makes for a quite interesting place, an Eastern European traditional population within a German-speaking empire. And one of my trips to the National Archives in Krakow for a different project that I was involved in, I just came across by chance, and that's how we find usually the most interesting thing, of a file with names of hundreds of Jewish girls from age 14 and on, who are, depending on the type of files that I looked at, who expressed their desire to convert to Roman Catholicism. This is something I never heard about. I became very interested in it, and in subsequent trips, I kept on looking for more material, and I also started checking the contemporary press. I looked for other archival sources and so on. Very quickly, I became aware that this is a big story that I can't just talk about the girls. It involved a different context, the legal context, and so on. And I started collecting material. I published a few articles. So this is how it started.
I see. So What you mentioned about the context and how there were specific things about this context. So could you paint a picture a little bit? What exactly is the chronological period that your book focuses on? And what is distinct about the geographical area in which this story takes place?
Okay. So the period that I'm discussing is starting in 1869, when the law of mandatory education was published by the Habsburg Empire. As I said, Galicia was part of the Habsburg Empire. I had to look into that law. It turned out that a few years later, there was a version of the law applicable to Galicia, while the Habsburg mandatory education law required 8 years of schooling, the Galician version of the law required only 6 years of schooling. Another law, if I'm talking about the legal context, and this I became aware of it once I started looking into police reports and court cases and so on. There was a law that defined a civil procedure for conversion. And while, according to Austrian law, a minor was defined as somebody who didn't reach age 24, for the purpose of conversion, anybody who reached the age of 14 could choose his or her religion. So it created a sort of a clash because as far as the parents were concerned, in this case, their daughter was still a minor, but converting was done according to the law. And even more than that, according to the law, the authorities were supposed, if there were somebody would put obstacles on the desire to convert of that individual, the law was supposed, or the authorities were supposed to support that convert. The law didn't interfere in the religious rituals or whatever. There was just a civil procedure. It was done to make sure that conversion, doesn't matter from which religion to which, but to make sure that things are not done in secret and so on. So while the intentions were good, the results, at least in the Jewish case, were troublesome for the Jewish population. So that's the legal context. And apparently Jewish girls found out very quickly that if they want to run away from home, this is what they could do, because we're talking about 1873 and on. Where could a young girl go to if she runs away from home? So there was one specific convent in Krakow. It's still there. It's a beautiful convent. It's very close to the old city. And this was the only convent that had what we call a katechumenat, a place where that prepared, in our case, girls for conversion, teaching them whatever they needed to know about Roman Catholicism. So they would generally stay there for several months, had a room and board. In many cases, they were also trained for a profession, governess or something like that, and the convent would help them find a position when they left. So we have the legal context, we have this institution, and then this is also, especially the beginning in the 1900s and on, it's also a period of the rise of the feminist movement in Poland, and Krakow was a place where this was particularly I mean, feminists were particularly active, providing free lectures for women and so on. So we have feminism, we have mandatory education, we have this law about conversion. So those are some of the elements that in the context of what enabled this phenomenon to take place.
I hear you. And so you mentioned, you sort of hinted at the question of motivation, and I want to come back to that in a second, but I just want to have you put the end, the chronological endpoint of your analysis. So you say you're looking at from the 1870s until when? When is the endpoint of this?
Okay,
view?
So after World War One, this is a dissolution of the Habsburg Empire, and Galicia becomes a part of Poland. Especially Kraków now is a part of Poland. And unlike the Habsburg Empire, independent Poland, or the Second Republic of Poland, didn't have a civil procedure for conversion. Rather, it was done according, and this is my understanding, I was in touch with many Polish scholars about this point, it was done according to the canon law. Now, in Poland, the age of majority was not 24, unlike in the Habsburg Empire, but 21, but minors who wanted to convert, they had to approach first the bishop. So this easy path of just knocking, you know, on the door of the convent and declaring the wish to convert, this kind of path ended once the Polish Second Republic was established. So it doesn't mean that there were no more converts to Roman Catholicism, but that easy path of girls running away from home, knowingly that there is a place where they could stay, this really stopped. So this, what I call the phenomenon of running away from home, ended with the end of the Habsburg Empire.
I see. So you mentioned about the question of motivation. And I think certainly for me, when I started to read your fascinating book, and I think probably for a lot of other people, when they hear about this this period and this phenomenon that you're looking at, they right away wonder, well, were these conversions sincere? You say that there are several hundred women who grew up in very, you know, Orthodox Jewish homes who then ran away to this particular convent and converted to Christianity. Were these sincere conversions, that these young women really embraced the teachings of Christianity, or were these really strategic maneuvers in order to avoid a lifestyle or restrictions that the women found burdensome?
So some of them were sincere. I mentioned in the book two cases that were brought in front of the Viennese Supreme Court of two young women, and they definitely were sincere in their conversion. Also, one of the stories that I reconstruct in the book, that of Michalina Aratin, she also is my, not just impression, it's clear from what became from her later, she was also sincere. So they were those who especially, I discuss in the book what were the Polish schools at that time, the public schools. Some might think, well, it's a public school, it's a secular school, but Roman Catholicism is part of Polish identity to this day. And going to a school like this, they would have they would take trips to local churches, which had a history behind them. Definitely the holidays were celebrated and so on. Some of the girls stayed in the class, although they were exempt, when religion instructions on the Catholic religion were taught. So some definitely wanted to convert to the religion of the majority. Others, as you said, it was strategic. They were running away from an arranged marriage in many cases. And I explained in the book, because I mentioned before that there was a mandatory education law. But the Orthodox, through political agreements with the Polish political authorities, were able to make sure that the boys, their sons, would continue to go to cheder. While the Orthodox had no problem of sending their daughters to Polish schools, because the Jewish tradition doesn't really prescribe, instructions how to educate daughters. While there are instructions and traditions how to educate boys, and at that time, unlike in other provinces of the Habsburg Empire, the cheder was still very all Orthodox Jews send their sons to cheder. Sometimes they're supplemented with private lessons and so on. And when because of that, the gap between the girls who were educated in school, knew the Polish language, and the boys who received, in most cases, only a religious education, the gap between them kept going. And when the time came for an arranged marriage, they didn't find anything in common with guys like this. And for some of them, because those arranged marriages, in many cases, the father would just tell his daughter, "I have a guy for you." And the engagement will take place in 2 weeks, as in one of the cases that I described. So women, young women who were very strong-willed, who knew exactly what they wanted, took the step of, the radical step, I would say, of running away.
Right. Yes. And and speaking of some of these cases, what was the Aratin affair? What could you tell us a little bit about what that case was like?
Okay, so Aratin, the Aratin case, or as it became known, the Aratin affair, was the first case that was widely reported in the press, Jewish press, the Viennese press, even the London Times wrote about it. In America, there were reports about it. And this really started a debate within the Jewish society about the education of women. So Aratin, or Michalina Aratin, was a daughter of a very rich Hasidic family. For those who are familiar, the father was of the inner circle of the Gera Rebbe, the Sfat Emet. She was born in the Lodz area, or Łódź, which at that time was under the Russian Imperial Russia. But they moved to Krakow. His father, her grandfather, lived in Krakow. They moved there. And as was customary with rich Hasidim, they wouldn't just send her to a public school, but they sent her to one of the best Polish private schools. She apparently was very smart. By the way, all those things that I'm telling you now, I had to put together from police investigation, the court files, and so on. When she finished the sixth grade, her father pulled her out of school, even though this school had eight grades. As I said before, in Galicia, the mandatory education was limited to sixth grade. It's not clear to me why exactly he pulled her out of school. They also provided her with music lessons and so on. And at one point, about a year later, she spotted from her window a military, an Austrian military officer. At that time, the Austrian army had garrisons in Krakow. And she kept on looking at him every day. I'll make a long story short. He threw a note from his window. She sent a neighbor her age to pick it up. And he invited her to take a tram ride. They met another time, and the second time they walked at the center of the city at the Rinne, for those who are familiar. Now, this is a very bold move of a Hasidic daughter. She initiated it, but he picked up on it. And apparently, when her father found out about it, he beat her with his belt. I found out that apparently this wasn't very unusual. So I wouldn't call him an abusive father. And according to the testimony of the military officer, once he discovered that, he decided to stop all the relationship he had with her, which amounted, according to his testimony and her testimony, to just two meetings. She apparently sent him several notes, letters. He wouldn't answer. And then she sent him a letter, and I have the letter. It was in the court file, telling him that her father called her. He told her she's soon to be 15, and this is a time for her to get married. And she called the guy he picked for her a wax doll. I kind of try to, hypothesize who that might be. It's not clear to me, but I have a guess in the book. And she said she doesn't want to, she won't marry that guy. She's really upset. She wanted to throw herself out of the window, and she can't stay home. She asked him for advice. He didn't answer. But she got engaged according to the dates that she mentions. So let's say it was on a Sunday. So on the following Shabbat, which was December 30, 1899, she ran away from home and she went to that convent. A month later, she disappeared, which makes it into really a sensational story. Apparently, she didn't want to meet her father when he came to visit several times. She did meet in the convent her grandparents, some aunts, and so on. But what's interesting in this story, and all those stories are not just stories of daughters, they're stories of families. It's never an isolated kind of story. And the father, who was if I remember correctly, in his late 30s, so he was he was a young man. He was rich. He used all his money and contacts. He met with Austrian ministers. He hired a private detective. He offered money for tips. So the story includes also many of what happened as a result of those tips and so on, and everything was reported in the press, in the Jewish press, in the anti-Semitic press, in the liberal press, in the socialist press, and so on. So it also becomes the story of her father. He also at one point tried to show that she's not 14 yet, and to claim that the convent can't keep her because it's a violation of the law. And then I have in that chapter also a postscript, which I won't go into now. She's buried in a Jewish cemetery in Haifa in Israel. Okay, I'm not sure whether she really returned to Judaism or not, but that's her story. And this opened, and the story was described, especially in the liberal press, and I'm talking about major newspapers like the Neue Freie Presse, which was the most important Viennese newspaper. So in the newspapers, those cases, her and other cases, are described as abductions. So this is her story.
Yeah. Right. So you mentioned that these, runaways ended up sometimes having a much larger kind of social consequences, or that they're developed all sorts of narratives about these young women. And you mentioned that a key framing for the runaways was the idea of an abduction narrative, that it wasn't that the women wanted to, made a conscious decision to embrace Christianity, but they were somehow abducted by the convent, by the nuns, and that this was really happening against the will of these young women. And certainly we can imagine, both from a Jewish perspective as well as from a liberal sort of anti-clerical perspective, this framing would be advantageous. I'm curious, you also mentioned that there were other aspects of the kinds of narratives that were developed around these young women, and one of them had to do with a charge of mental illness. Could you speak a little bit about how the claim of mental illness fit into some of these narratives about these young runaways?
Okay, so this charge was also connected to Michalina Arat and not to the two other cases that I discussed. Apparently, her fiancé and the father went to the father sent several doctors to the convent, and one of the trying to claim that she's sick, as a father, he wanted his daughter back, so he tried all kinds of avenues how he can get her, claiming that she's too young or whatever. And because she had, and this is my assumption, because she had that relationship with a military officer, her fiancé told the doctor that he suspects that she has syphilis and she's her mental state should be checked as a result of the relationship. He doesn't say relationship. He just said that he thinks that she had syphilis. And indeed, the father sent to her a psychiatrist, a professor, the head of a mental institution that also was in charge of checking prostitutes twice a week. That was the kind of the norm. Prostitute had to get a certificate that they're clean and healthy and so on. So the father sent this psychiatrist to check her. And he said she's perfectly fine. She's intelligent and so on. But interestingly, when she left the convent and disappeared, she left a letter for her father. And in the letter, which is also in the court case, in the court file, I mean, and she said that she's it's more than a hint. She says it specifically that she was afraid that her father was going to commit her to a mental institution by force, and she brought it as one of the reasons of her decision to run away. Because her father, really more than the other parents that I discussed in the book, he was really he wouldn't stop at anything to get her back. So, and of course, this excuse of explaining conversion as a result of a mental kind of infliction was not used here for the first time. So,
right, there's a history to the charge of mental illness against religious deviants or other people who are not following the norm of either Judaism or other organized religions. It's interesting.
Yeah, because why would a daughter who grows up in a rich home has everything that any girl might want, why would she run away from home to a convent? She must be mentally ill. So I don't think he just used it as an excuse, but.
Right. I think that this, to me, as someone who studies contemporary examples of people who leave the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community, I know that this claim is also used today, which is why it jumped out at me when I saw it in your book. And I think what you were just saying really hints at part of the power of this claim. On the one hand, if someone is mentally ill, it's a very strong explanation or a very strong sort of argument to use against their ability to act, to go and do whatever they want. Well, they have a mental illness. We, their family, their community, the state should intervene to try to quote unquote, protect them. At the same time, on a cognitive level, on a psychological level, it really helps explain an apparent puzzle to the family members or the original community. Like you were saying, if someone has such a good life, especially this one woman's case where she grew up in such a wealthy home where she was given all of these luxuries and freedoms, why would she possibly turn her back on them? And it this creates a real puzzle for the people that knew her, and trying to answer why she did this. Well, if it turns out that she has a mental illness, that's a kind of neat explanation for this apparent inexplicable life choice.
If I may add to that, the experience of the girls that I described was unfamiliar to the parents. They never went to a Polish school. They had no idea. For them, they send them to the school. Later, they get betrothed to the guy that the parents are choosing for them, and everything is fine. They just couldn't imagine that experience and that double life that those girls lived in, in a Polish-speaking environment, having Polish friends, being appreciated in school for their intellectual capacities, which is something new for girls, and then coming home to a Yiddish-speaking home, which can't be more remote from their experience in school. So this is also part of that clash, the misunderstanding of each side of the of what is the other side is going through.
Right. You mentioned that these stories eventually, anyway, received a lot of attention in the popular press and even in the Jewish press. So certainly the religious leaders of the Orthodox or Hasidic community in these areas were certainly aware of what was happening. How did they respond to this a large group of women leaving their community?
Okay, before I answer that, if I may, one of the cases that I described is of a young woman who ran away not with the intention to convert, although she found at the beginning refuge in a convent. She just wanted to continue her studies. She wanted to go to the university, first to high school, and so on. And she was a descendant of the founder of the Sanz Hasidic dynasty, and she also, her story also becomes a huge sensational story in the press. So after starting in 1900 with the Aradin case, there is a debate in the press, in the Jewish press, And even some in the non-Jewish press brought as a reason the fact of the of this huge gap between young men and young women in the society. And the Jewish, I would say, like religiously moderate press, Zionist, for those who are familiar, Hamagid, Hamitzpeh, they blame the education that the Orthodox give to their daughters, and they suggested to have schools for them to teach them the Torah, to teach them Jewish history, and so on. But the Orthodox press rejected it. They said the problem is not a lack of religious Jewish education. The problem is too much secular education. So each side, held on steadfastly to their position until the war.
Right, and so the religious the rabbis themselves, you mention particularly strong response by Rabbi Eliyahu Akiva Rabinovich, and how did he feel towards Jewish education, formal Jewish education for the young women in the community?
Okay, so this was in 1903. There was a rabbinical conference, a very unusual conference because it had the participants, the rabbis came from all over, from the Middle East. From Rabinovich was from Ukraine, from Poltava. He was known, although he later changed, as a kanai, as a zealot. And when one of the rabbis suggested to establish the Talmud Torah, religious schools for girls, he lashed out and he said something like that won't be. So I think it's also because the idea to give girls religious education, textual, teach them religious text and so on, because it was suggested by the moderate and by those who opposed the Orthodox side. So accepting it would be like, claiming we're wrong and you're right. So there were also political reasons, I think, for that. It became a marker of how religious you are. And if you, the more zealous you are, you just keep the norms as they were until then.
And so essentially not much was done on the part of the Orthodox Jewish establishment in terms of responding to the situation.
Yeah, it was among the ultra-Orthodox. There were several school, Krakow is still there, the temple, the Jewish progressives, they're not like the reformers in Germany. They had several programs for girls. There were also a society named Ruth, which offered religious classes for women. So there were several initiatives, but not by the Orthodox, which became, everybody's doing what they can, but the Orthodox are resisting. And part of the resistance is there were those who were interested. I mentioned Rabbi Shvadron, who is known as a legal Jewish religious legal authority. He had an idea of establishing a school system for boys and for girls, but he was attacked by the newspaper of the ultra-Orthodox, Machzikei Adas, which was under the auspices of the Bels Hasidim. So it had a chilling effect. You don't want to say anything because you're going to be attacked. So this was also part of it. It's not that there was no will at all, but the political situation and the fights between different Hasidic courts scared people off to come up with any innovative suggestions.
Right. And in this in this environment. How does the story of Sarah Schneer and the Beit Yaakov movement that she began, how does this fit in? If you could tell us a little bit about Sarah Schneer herself, and then how her vision and her program for Jewish education for women fit into this landscape.
Okay, so I refer to this, and I cite this description from a contemporary article, this generation of women, as the lost generation, as one of the people who later, one of the rabbis who later became involved in the education of women called them. And my claim is that Sarah Schneer was also she also belonged to that lost generation. She was herself also from Krakow, so she was definitely aware of what was going on. She writes with a lot of pride about the school she went to, the public school. I was able to identify the school that she went to. She apparently also wanted to continue after she finished primary school. She wanted to continue her studies, but she came from a family of meager means, and she had to help out and get a job. That's how the story goes. The only source we have is what she tells us. So that story, according to that story, in 1915, during World War I, she fled with her family to Vienna, and there she frequented a synagogue of Rabbi Flesch, who was a sort of a neo-Orthodox. He studied in Frankfurt. He was not really a neo-Orthodox, but he really was attracted to the writings of Samson Raphael Hirsch. And as she tells, and I found several sources where, as we know, you people who write their autobiographies, sometimes, you know, they tell a story from I don't want to say that she invented things, but she definitely corrected it here and there. So according to her, she heard a sermon of his about Judith and Hanukkah. She was so impressed because the sermon was given to men and women. Women who sat in the women's gallery, of course, in Krakow. Hasidic rabbis wouldn't give sermons with women there. They would most of them would give their sermons at the Shabbos table, from which women were excluded. She was very impressed. She started attending his classes and so on. And at that time, she said she heard a voice. I don't know if she means it metaphorically speaking, telling her that she must, start a school to educate Jewish girls. She goes back to Krakow, and this, I mean, I'm telling what a lot of people, after reading what she writes, are repeating the same story. She first establishes an association of teenagers, and later she goes, following the advice of her brother, to the Belzer Rebbe, and she starts an afternoon school. And I want to make it clear that it was an afternoon school, because all she had is a primary school education. So it was an afternoon school in the beginning in her apartment to teach girls in the afternoon basic Jewish knowledge. As I show in the book, she didn't teach the Pentateuch. Later, when the Aguda party took the school over, they didn't teach the Pentateuch there either. Because the claim is that she wanted to teach Torah to girls. That wasn't the case. That came only later. And after Aguda takes it over, small towns in the neighborhood, you could see that there was a thirst for this type of education for girls. Several communities, they sent girls to see what she's doing, and they established schools in their neighborhood. And this is, to make a long story short, it ends up with a whole system of mostly afternoon schools. There were several full-fledged schools, but most of them are afternoon schools. And the flagship of this movement is a seminary also in Kharkov. I claim in the book that not Warsaw, but Kharkov, which was the eye in the storm, the eye of the storm, with all those stories that I discussed, this is now going to be the place of, changing what happened before. And it's a seminary to train teachers for those afternoon school, teachers of the Jewish religion. It's not like a seminary for just to train teachers, but teachers of the Jewish religion.
And then eventually, this Beis Yaakov movement develops a whole educational system in America and Israel and maybe other places where you have a full day, like regular schools, day schools for a young Orthodox Jewish girls, right?
Yeah, there was several day school. They were not referred to as day school at this time. One scholar, he claimed that there were 14 school, full-fledged schools. I couldn't find all of them, but in Warsaw there were three schools, also in Lodz, some other places. I don't go beyond the Polish case in the book. But my claim is, since it's referred to as a revolution, a revolutionary movement, my claim is that it was a revolution in religious and Jewish religious education, but it's a counter-revolution in women's education. Because this was the only, until at least 1937, this was the only post-primary option, is a teacher seminary. In 1937 or 36, I don't remember, there were also two schools were established to train girls for in one of them to be like not exactly social workers, but to do social types of to get social types of positions, and the other one they could it was a post-primary school, but it wasn't a real high school that would offer what's called like a baccalaureate exam that would enable girls to enter a university. So this option of a continued education, which women started fighting for in the last decades of the 19th century, this option was rejected by the Beis Yaakov, and the teacher seminary, which was the hallmark of female education in 1870, became now the top, and for the, you know, for intellectually capable girls, because this was the top educational institution. So I look at it, from the both sides.
All right. Well, before we let you go, I wanted to ask you, just to shift gears here a little bit and ask you, what are you working on now, or what is the next project that you're working on? If you could tell us a little bit about it.
Okay, so this is a project that I started before writing this book, I put it aside, and now I'm returning to that. I'm returning to my interest in politics and social history, although the women's story is also in the context of social history. It's a history of Galician Jews from the time of annexation from 1772 until 1867, when the Jews were emancipated following the publication of the Austrian constitution. So I call it From Polish Jews to Austrian Citizens. It is arranged according to topics, religion, communal institutions. I have also a chapter on marriage law and so on. It's basically on the relationship between the Jews and the relationship of Jews to the state, and the attitude or the relationship of the state to the Jews as it manifested itself in the legal system.
Wow, that so sounds fascinating. That sounds fascinating. I look forward to reading that as well. Well, we want to thank you, Rachel, for taking your time to share your thoughts with us today. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you.
That concludes our program. Thanks for listening and have a great day.